All right, y'all go ahead and mark your calendars. Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th is the Mobile Hunters Expo in Dalton, Georgia. Y'all have heard us talking about it for years, and it really is. It's the highlight of our summer. We absolutely love that show. We've met so many of you guys at that show over the years, and it is just it's like the perfect environment to go and meet like-minded hunters, hang out, have a good time, and get ready for deer season. So obviously, as the name implies, it is the place to go and try all of the mobile hunting gear coming out right now. We always recommend to people, if you're thinking about getting a new stand, a new sticks, a new saddle, go try it before you buy it. The Mobile Hunters Expo let you try almost all the brands in the mobile hunting space in one spot in one day. There's really nothing like it. So not only do you have all that gear available to you, they also have a great speaker lineup. This year they've got Bobby Worthington, Dylan Harper, Mariah Boggess, Derek Norwood, and BHA all giving presentations where you can go learn from those guys and ask them questions. So if you've heard us talk about the Mobile Hunters Expo for a couple years now and haven't made it out yet, don't let this be another year that you miss it. Y'all come on out. We'll have a great time. We're excited to meet you guys there. We can't wait for it. We'll see y'all there. Again, mark y'all's calendars. It's at the Dalton Convention Center in Dalton, Georgia, Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th. See y'all there. All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck, and I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic, and no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just Southern deer hunters or Southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com. You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just southern deer hunters or southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Southern Outdoorsman Podcast. This one has been a long time coming. I'm very excited to have this discussion because today we're going to do the ultimate deep dive on deer vision with probably the most qualified person on the planet to talk about it, Dr. Carl Miller. Dr. Carl, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to be here.
Yep. We just recorded one a little while ago, so it's kind of weird. We're just like doing intros again. It's like, anyways, Brian Murphy, how are you doing?
Doing fantastic.
Yep. Jacob, how are you?
Doing great. This is an interesting conversation. This is something I'm very interested to get us into. So, Andrew, how do you want to kick it off?
So this originally started, we were looking for biology topics to talk about because I was telling you earlier, Brian, like there's a hunger for it. Like people really want to know about these things and particularly deer vision. There's just a lot of, I don't know, maybe misnomers around it. I don't think it's very well understood. And you know, while the sense of smell is obviously their first line of defense and their best line of defense.
We'll discuss that.
Oh! We're starting off with some controversy. Okay.
That's the assumption, but there's some, yeah.
It's wrong.
All right. Let's get into it. All right, let's talk about it. So first of all, how did you get involved with deer vision? Like, what's the story about this?
Well, kind of the story, you know, at the University of Georgia Deer Lab, we've been doing deer research on all aspects of deer physiology, deer nutrition, deer habitat use, deer movement patterns. But one thing we've tried to keep a focus on at some point, it's something going on at all times, is a kind of investigations into deer sensory perception. Trying to get inside a deer's head, because that's basically what I wanted to do. I wanted to figure out how to kill them better. You know, so trying to understand how they perceive the environment is key to doing that. And we've had a number of studies. We started off doing a lot of scent communication type research first, and we did some deer hearing, but we've always had something going on with deer vision, starting way back in the 1990s. And we've had teams of graduate students, and we've had some tremendous graduate students who are really clever, and we've done a number of studies, and each one builds on the next one. And we started out in 1990, but what we've learned in the last 30 years, I think each time we learn something new, it makes us appreciate how much different deer perceive their world through their sense of vision than we do. They see an entirely different landscape. And to understand that, it helps you select your camel patterns. It helps you select how you hunt. It selects where you hunt, how you move in your stands, and so forth. And I mean, it's key to the deer's survival. You mentioned their sense of smell being the key one. The sense of smell is key for them to find food. That's what the sense of smell is primarily used for, because deer don't go through the woods with a dendrology book identifying plants. They identify what they're going to eat with their sense of smell. But the sense of smell, although it's useful as far as minimizing predation, it comes with a hitch to it. If the predator is downwind or crosswind, it's totally ineffective. The only way the sense of smell is effective as far as predator avoidance is if the deer is downwind of the predator. So, you know, that's not their first line of defense. Their first line of defense is their eyes. and their eyes are keenly adapted to do two things. One of them, which is to detect movement, and the other one is to be able to move themselves through a very complex environment at a high rate of speed, which they can do that we can't, right? And as you see, as we go through this, you'll see some of the difference between their vision and how it's adapted for that versus our vision, which is adapted or designed to do what humans do. Deer are designed to do what deer do. We're designed to do what humans do, and they're not the same thing. We don't do the same things. So that's how we got started.
Okay. And yeah, this initially, we were at the GON Expo a couple weeks ago, and I was talking to you, Brian, and I was like, man, I really want to do one on deer vision. We were just talking about this before we got started. And you're like, funny you mentioned that. I know, like, the guy.
Well, I'm just the guy because I was the guy here with all the graduate students working under me. They're actually the workhorses that did the work. Mm-hmm. I just kind of put it all together at the end. And some of that, the original work done, we started way back in the early 1990s, and Brian was key at coordinating that one. It was a study where we actually got into the deer's eye to look at deer's ability to see in different colors, whether they see black and white or whether they actually do have color vision. And I'll let you go explain some of that.
Yeah, this was early in our learning curve on deer vision, and we had some assumptions based on how the deer's eyes structured compared to humans and difference in pupil shape and size and a number of things that we had a pretty good idea, we thought, of how a deer perceived the world, but there was still a lot of debate, particularly among the hunting community, of whether or not deer can see blaze orange. What colors could they see? Are they colorblind? You know, from one end of the spectrum to the other. And so I was working at that time as a wildlife research coordinator for the University of Georgia, working under Dr. Miller and Dr. Larry Marchington, and we devised a vision study. And yet we didn't have any in-house experts on vision at that time and the equipment that was required. So we reached out to the two top vision researchers that did mammalian vision research. One was at the University of Wisconsin. One was at the University of Southern California. South Carolina, Santa Barbara. UC Santa Barbara. Sorry, let me get it correct. And that was almost 30-plus years ago now. It was 1992. And the only way we could get those guys interested to come out and do we wanted whitetail vision work done was if we widened the scope. So we ended up doing cattle, sheep, goats, fallow deer, and whitetail deer. So we had to coordinate this study to be able to handle and get our hands on animals, you know, from all those categories. And I remember as a young research coordinator being tasked with how to move a sedated steer into a laboratory environment and put them into what we call a stereotaxic, which is basically a vise for the head to keep it still, because we had to have motionless sedated animals put a device on their eye and introduce different wavelengths of light into the animal's eye. And I'll let Carl get into the science. But we did this initial landmark research in 92. The first paper came out a couple of years later. And that was just the beginning of this process that Carl's going to elaborate on, of kind of learning not just what colors they see, but how they perceive their environment, how can a buck run through a forested environment at nighttime at a full rate of speed and not whack its head on something. You ever thought about how that is? I can't run through that during the daytime without whacking my head on something. So how does a deer do it with a set of antlers that it can't see? A deer can't see its antlers on its head, right? You know, we can look in a mirror at things. They can't. So they have to feel their environment, and they have to be able to do this at a high rate of speed. And so what we came out with after that initial study were probably more questions than answers, but we were able to definitively determine that deer had that they were dichromats. We're trichromats. We'll talk about that in a minute, but they see in two broad spectrums. We see in three. So there's certain wavelengths of light that deer don't perceive the way we do, and thankfully we at least put the question to bed about blaze orange, that deer don't have the cone photoreceptor capable of distinguishing that color from other colors. You know, in that sort of red-green spectrum, doesn't make it invisible, doesn't disappear to them. It just can't be differentiated. You know, it's similar to protanopia, I think, in humans.
Well, it's further out the spectrum than for the humans. So, like, when we see reds get darker and darker and darker, they turn to black. Well, at the end of the spectrum, we get into the orange. As you start getting into the orange towards the reds, that's where it starts to turn to black. Deer don't see as deep into that part of the spectrum as we do.
Right. So we got a lot of good introductory information, and I think put some of those things to bed. But there were still some unanswered questions about the UV spectrum at that time.
Right.
That later were you know I'll let you jump into that sort of whole.
We'll talk about it. I think what would be real instructive, if we just looked at vision in general and take you back to your high school science days that you guys were sleeping through, right?
Of course.
And talk about how humans see first to make sure everybody's on the page with what humans see. And then that'll help us decide the differences how deer see. So we know photons of light enter into the deer's or the human's eye, right? They cross over the cornea and they go through the pupil opening and they hit the lens there. The lens inverts that image and projects it onto the retina. Now on the retina, we have both rods and cones. Rods have a single photoreceptor on them, which means they can only see in black and white. Either they fire or they don't fire. They don't distinguish wavelengths. And there's what we see in dim light conditions. You know, when it gets towards dark, you see everything's kind of grainy. You don't see colors real well. That's primarily because we're using our rod vision at that time. Our cones are what we see in color. And our cones are focused on a very central point of our eye called a fovea centralis. There's one little spot right in the center of our eye that has an extremely high density of cones. And our cones have three photoreceptors. One peaks in blue, one in red, and one in kind of red, green, and blue, right? So we are trichromats. Now, interesting how our eyes work is we always try to keep the image we're looking at pointed towards that fovea centralis. So our eyes are active all the time. Every time we're looking at something, our eyes are continually moving. Whether we're reading, we're looking at somebody's face. You don't look at somebody's face. You're looking at a point on somebody's face. And we can accommodate for distance on that, but we actually try to track that spot. That's where we get our visual acuity from because of the high density of cones there, and that's where we get our color vision from. As you move out into your peripheral vision, you lose a lot of that those cones that are reflected onto the retina. And we lose some of our color perception. And we get out to about, 120 degrees and we lose our peripheral vision completely. Well, deer's eyes are very, very different than that. So based on that first study, like Brian said, we found out that deer have two cone photopigments. One of them is almost identical to our blues. And one is kind of halfway between our reds and the greens. So they see kind of in a yellow and blue hue. And every other thing they see is a combination of those two. It's kind of like a human with what's called red-green color blindness, protanopia. Okay, that was based on the physiology of the animal. But there are a lot of other things that can affect vision besides just the physiology. We knew they had the physiological capability, but how well they could see those colors was the next big question. So a couple of the things we tried to do is, one of the things we wanted to do is to look at the retina of the deer's eye. Well, let me back up. I'm going to actually add a couple more things that's different between a deer's eye before we get into that. Deer's eyes are adapted to be able to see at nighttime very well. Ours are not. We are a diurnal species. We do not move much at night. Deer eyes can see, for a variety of reasons, see much bigger. They have a wider pupil opening, and you know that an objective lens gathers more light, its light gathering ability increases by the square of the diameter, right? So a deer's pupil opening, if it opens three times ours, we give them nine times the ability to gather light in dim light conditions, right? That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is behind their rods and cones on the deer's eye, they have what is called a tapetum. And that tapetum is a reflective layer of cells that reflects that light back out of those rods, over those rods and cones a second time, which again doubles the light gathering ability. So you just went from 9 to 18, right? And you're all familiar with this. You've seen that light, right? It's the deer's eye shine.
Not that you'd be doing anything illegal like spotlighting. Yeah. This is just in your headlights. Yeah, yeah. This is just on the side of the road, right? And deer are not the only species that have this tapetum, right? A number of species do. We don't, but night adapted, nocturnal adapted species, many do have eye shine because that gives them a mirror in the back of their eye to reflect the light back through twice. As Carl said, light goes into our eye, gets absorbed, we get one time use only. Those species with the tapetum get a double chance to magnify the light twice and to reflect it off that mirror. And see.
You think about all the nocturnal species, a cat, a dog, a whippoorwill, an alligator, all these species have a tapetum and they all eye shine. One thing neat, Dr. Gino D'Angelo, when he was working on his PhD, did some of this work that we're going to talk about. And one of the things he did was dissect out the tapetum and looked at the tapetum in the back of the deer's eyes. It turns out it doesn't cover the whole retina. It actually covers the top part down to the middle of the retina, and there's not much tapetum in the bottom. So think about why that might be. I'm putting you guys on the spot.
Dude, all right. I don't feel qualified to answer this.
Okay, remember what I said. The light hits the lens.
Inversion.
Yeah. Okay.
and it inverts it, right? Uh-huh. Okay. So light that's hitting the top of the eye is coming from where? Down below.
Down below.
Light that's hitting the bottom is coming from up above. So there's a lot of celestial light up there, and moonlight, and, you know, there's just the sky at nighttime can have some light associated with it. What the deer wants to do is accentuate the part that it can't see as well. So it increases that ability. Okay. So that's just a neat observation. Now, the other thing Dr. D'Angelo did as part of his dissertation is he got into the back of the deer's eye and mapped out the distribution of the rods and the cones, particularly the cones, because that's where the color vision comes from. Now, remember I said we have a very centered point, right? It turns out deer do not. Their blue cones are kind of scattered all throughout the retina at a relatively high density, not as dense as we have in our fovea centralis, but kind of in our peripheral vision. But the higher wavelength cones, photopigments, are actually on a band across the back of the retina. They're not concentrated on one individual point because deer don't look like we do. Now, if you coupled that with the idea that a deer's pupil opening is an oval shape along the horizon, and you've got a band along the retina, think about what that does with the deer's ability to see. Where's a predator going to come from? The horizon. They're not coming from the ground. They're not coming. They don't. You know, eagles don't take a lot of deer. You know, so they're most worried about a predator that's, you know, on the horizontal with them. So that gives them a very good ability to keep not just one individual point in focus, but it keeps the whole panorama in focus. So. But the problem is their cone density on that retinal streak, is what we call it, is not near as high as our cone density that we have, which we'll get into the deer's visual acuity, which is not as good as ours, believe it or not.
Let me make a point here. I think you made a good one from a hunting perspective. What Carl's saying there is that if I'm standing there watching a deer walk across a field, I've got to move my head to keep that deer in focus, right, for that same concept. A deer, on the other hand, watching me walk across a field can stay motionless, and I stay in equal focus across that band on its retina that is different than ours. So we have to, because we have that very fine visual acuity, we can read a newspaper. A deer couldn't. They could keep a lot in general focus, but we have to look at a very specific spot. So to keep something in focus, we have to keep moving our eyes and stay focused on it. That's why a deer can stay completely motionless and watch you walk across a field and keep you in equal focus across its band on its eyes that we can't do.
Good way to see this, you know, it's hard to get up on a deer and watch them watch something, but if you watch a horse has a very similar vision. If you see a horse standing out in a pasture and it sees a vehicle go by, what's it do? You know, it just moves its head. It never moves its eyes, but that vision, that vehicle going by is actually moving across the retina. So it's engaging new cones as it moves, as the vehicle moves, without turning the deer's head, which makes it very easy to pick up that movement. And it's going to be even easier when we get to something else we're going to talk about as well.
So on that real quick, I'm curious, maybe this is a little bit too early to bring it up, but does that also screw up their depth perception?
Yeah, we're going to talk about
that. We'll get to that.
Jumping ahead. I've got a question specifically about the eye movement and everything. Do deer have the capability, like us, like we can run our eyes, you know, not quite all the way to your peripheral, but, you know, pretty wide going back and forth. Can deer move their eyes like that, or is it mostly just moving?
They can move their eyes some.
Okay.
Deer have, you know, their peripheral vision, they have about 100 or 310 degree angle. You can sneak up behind the deer if you stay right behind the deer. But if you're off to the side any degree, they can see you as well as if you're standing right off to the side of them. Mm-hmm. And you're just as good, just as clear vision as they're looking straight at you.
Yeah. That's why that deer can be looking ahead and spot you draw to the right because you're still on that band. You're still in focus to them.
But remember, it's a band. And if you're up here.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the important part of it.
Yeah.
Now, damn, where was I going to go?
depth perception.
We're doing trip.
Well, the idea with depth perception, remember, we're trying to focus that one point. So our eyes, our lens is elastic, and it opens and closes to get that focal length to fit right square under that fovea centralis. Deer don't have that ability to accommodate it as well. They have much more of a firm lens. So their depth perception is not as good as ours, at least at stationary objects. And I'm going to keep coming back to that, at stationary objects. because it's hard for a deer to perceive what something is, to identify something that's stationary. You've done this before. You've walked out in a field and you look at the end of the field and there's a deer and you say, "That's a deer." And what's the deer say? "What the hell's that?" You know,
yeah, head bob.
And it does. And why is it doing that head bob? It's trying
to get
the depth perception with you in the background and trying to get you to move, and it moves side to side, trying to get you to move so they can understand. Mm-hmm. It has a hard time picturing a 3D picture because it can't accommodate that well.
That and the fact that their eyes are on the side of their head. So anytime you start moving those eyes away from the point of center, depth perception suffers somewhat too. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of where those eyes, you know, it's a prey animal. It needs 310 degrees of, because it needs to check every possible angle from a predator. We are the predators, so we have a narrow field of view. That's okay. Our acuity is great. We need to see. That's the target, right? That's the animal we're after. We can't see worth a darn out here, but our eye placement allows us to get better depth perception and better acuity. Deer moving their eyes on the side of their head gives them different advantages. So it's, you know, as we'll get to it at the very end, which is better? There's no right answer. It depends on which animal you are. If you're human, we're better. If you're deer, you know, they do some things better.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have to reach down and pick things up and move them and manipulate them and stuff. So their vision is designed for outside, to look at something remote from them. And they get their acuity then, not from looking at a stationary object. We'll talk about a test we did of their visual acuity here in a minute. But they get it through motion. And that motion gives them that 3D image. And it's why they can run through the woods at breakneck speed, because instead of having to follow every stick, branch, you know, stump as they're running, they don't have to look at everything. They see it all play out as a panorama as they're going through the woods. That's just cool stuff.
That's cool.
Someone needs to make like a deer vision simulator where you can see what that would be like. Does that exist?
No, it's not. Because you still have to look through human eyes to see that, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh.
So unless you want to take your eye out and put a deer's eye in, I mean...
I mean, it's 2024. I mean, you know, people are doing some weird stuff these days.
I'll tell you, there's some hardcore whitetail hunters that, if given the chance, they would have their eyes replaced.
Yeah, we probably know a couple of them.
That would be really cool, wouldn't it? So if you look on top of that, then, one of the things that our visual acuity and having that really acute vision gives up, you have to give up something physiologically. And we give up a little bit on what's called processing speed. Now, deer don't have to have that real great focus. So that means they have an opportunity to have greater processing speed. And we actually did a study that looked at this processing speed. And it's called a flicker fusion rate. And this flicker fusion rate, you've all experienced this. You've seen these examples where a light starts flashing and it gets faster and faster and faster until you can't see it anymore, right? It's still flashing, but it overwhelms our eye's ability to process that information. Well, we did that with some deer. I had another student working on it, and she did some of these trials in our deer pens. We subsequently did it again with another student, and what it turns out is deer are able to see that flashing much. Much higher speeds than we are. As a matter of fact, it turns out their processing speed is somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 times our processing speed, which means that if there's movement, they can pick it up 4 to 5 times faster. When they're walking through the woods, it's like things are happening to them in slow motion. They can pick it up that well. You know, so that processing speed is just incredible, particularly in high light situations. It's not that much better. I mean, it's better in low light situations, but really high in high light situations. And that processing speed, you know, you hear about people saying they had a deer jump an arrow, right? And everybody thinks that they've heard the bow, right? Well, you know, I got to thinking about that, and the sound of speed is not that much faster than an arrow. So by the time the sound gets there, that arrow is just about there too. It doesn't really give them time to duck it. But to think of the fact that we can almost sometimes see an arrow in flight, but if they can process that information that much faster, they can probably track that arrow and see that arrow coming at them. Or at least they can see after the release, they see the bow move and the bow drop and stuff like that, and they can respond to that so quickly, their response time. Because as soon as the stimulus hits, they can hit the ground. And it's not necessarily maybe that they're ducking. It's that they're just getting down to make that bound, right? So I don't think it's sound, and I don't think silencers around bows are as important as, you know, not moving that much after the shot. Or making, I don't know, maybe using camouflage arrows. I don't know. Or supersonic arrows. I don't know. Something beyond the deer's ability to see them, you know. So I don't know this for sure, but it seems to make more sense to me. Okay, so that carries us up to another study that we did. We know that deer had the physiological capabilities to see blues and green and yellows, okay? But what did they actually see? So we had to design a study actually to get inside the deers and let the deer tell us what they see. And I had a really clever graduate student at the time named Brad Cohen, who's now a professor up at the University of Tennessee Tech. But he designed what we call a deer training apparatus, which works on a food reward. When the deer makes the right choice, it gets a reward. When it makes a wrong choice, it doesn't get a reward. So we set this thing up where we had two bins and we had lights over the bins. And when a trial start, there would be a buzzer goes off. The doors would open, and whichever one had the light on, if the deer went up to feed at that one, it was allowed to feed. If it went to the one that didn't have the light on, the door closed. It wasn't allowed to feed. So we trained the deer to respond. If it sees a light, it can eat. We just started with a white light. Well, then we worked with the Ever Ready Energizer, and they were real gracious to work with us, and they actually had their labs in China come up with these very specific LEDs for us. They had very specific wavelengths. And we tested them into the blue part of the spectrum and into the red part of the spectrum to see how well deer could see out in either one. And we ran these trials at different intensities of the light and at different wavelengths of the light over and over and over again. And it worked so well with one, we built eight of them. And we had these trials run constantly over and over and over again. And the deer were starting to give us, they were making the right choice. And as soon as it got down to a point where the deer could not make a right choice, you know, if it was a random choice, we know they couldn't see it anymore. So long story short, it turns out that deer see into the blue part or the red part of the spectrum very, very almost precisely what we predicted they would see as far as the physiology. And very similar to how we see out in that part. They don't see quite as far into the reds. But very intriguingly, they see the blue so much bit more vividly than we do. In fact, they see blues probably in the estimated around 20 times as well as we do. Blues are that vivid to them. Because we're a long-lived species. We have filters in our eyes that block out a lot of the UV light. Or, at, you know, at 40, 50 years old, our lenses are... Our retinas would get burned out. Deer don't live that long. You know, some places they live a year and a half, right? So so they don't have that filter in their lens that blocks out that UV, so it allows that light to actually come in. So their ability to see in the blues is incredible. Now, consider that compared to the hunter that goes out in the woods refusing to wear this, but wears blue jeans to a stand.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
This being a blaze orange hat for the audio listeners.
Yeah. And I think the concept that's important from a UV and a blue for the listeners out there that may be a little confused about all this wavelength and color is if you walked under a nightclub light with a pair of blue jeans on or a white shirt, something that reflects in that UV, that blue range that glows, that's what we're talking about here. So we don't see it the same way. And in fact, for many years, well, still to this day, in fact, since the 40s, the laundry detergent industry has figured out how to change the reflectance of UV light on fabric and move it from a spectrum we can't see into one we can. So the brighteners and whiteners in your laundry detergents actually are reflecting light differently off that fabric, moving it from an area that we don't see well into one we can. Well, it starts in an area that deer can already see well and moves it into one that
they even see better.
They even see better. So right. So you're actually making your hunting clothes more and more glow, you know, a greater and greater glow on your fabric just by adding those laundry detergents to your product. So you can have a otherwise good camo pattern or UV dead product that you can make UV hot just by putting – you know, washing them as normal.
Well, a lot of fabrics, even now in their dyes, have
built them in. Yeah,
they built them into them, and yeah. a lot of camels out there have it in them as well. Okay, so we can get a lot more into the UV brighteners and so forth. But the question is, why is blue so important to a deer? Okay, there's your quiz.
It's for nighttime?
What, yeah, nighttime. Okay, I was going to say, what light is reflecting in those low light hours?
Good job, Jacob.
Pre-dawn and post-sunset, there are a lot of ambient blues out there because they can actually filter through the where some of the longer wavelengths cannot. So they're relying on those blues a lot to see during those low light conditions. Do you ever wonder why a deer's got a white tail?
It reflects the UV.
It reflects blue.
Yeah.
White is reflecting of all the colors, right? Mm-hmm. And if there's a lot of ambient blue light out there, what is it reflecting? It's reflecting an awful lot of blues, right? So then deer has high capability of seeing blue. Why didn't they make it red? Because a deer can see blue real well. As a matter of fact, we know that particularly things like caribou can see ultraviolet even better than whitetails can. But that blue signal is how they navigate and stay cohesive in low light conditions because they're relying on the blue aspect of it as well.
And can you clarify real quick, white being on the blue side of the spectrum?
White is a combination of all the colors.
But how that reflects like the blue, just to, like maybe clarify for.
Okay, so if you got a white sheet out here and you put it on the table, it's going to reflect every color that's in the part of the spectrum that's coming from these lights. If it's nighttime, it's going to reflect what kind of light that there is available. And at nighttime, there's a lot of blue light available. Now, there's not many things out in the woods that do that, right? That reflect that are white, and that because it's white, it will reflect a lot of that blues. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Okay. I wanted you to kind of explain it, simplify it a little bit for the audio listeners. But no, that makes a ton of sense. An absolute ton of sense.
So now if you look at some of the camo patterns that are out there, there's a lot of them that have a lot of white embedded in them. And there's a lot of them that have what are called whiteners and brighteners as well that take a lot of that UV light and translate it back towards where the deer has their peak spectral sensitivity in that blue range. Now, I don't know if you've ever done that right before dusk, right before you get out of the stand, but if you've got some of that camo, look at your camo sometime, right before dark, and it looks like, to even a human, it almost looks like it's glowing. Think of what that looks like to a deer who can see that blue 20 times better. You're a glowing pair of legs or a glowing blob up on that, in that tree. And I've had that happen wearing some commercial camo. I've had deer come through that I know they didn't see me move, but they saw something up in that tree that they did not like. And it was something foreign to them, and they bolted. And it was the camo. It was perfectly designed, mimic camo and stuff like that. But it was the part of the spectrum that was giving them the reflectance.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and the detriment to that blue light is greatest at dawn and dusk. But when are we hunting most? When are we most likely to, most of us don't hunt midday as much as we do morning and evening, at least.
And when are you most active?
Yeah, so... when it hurts you the worst is when deer are most active. So it's a double-edged sword there for sure.
So, I mean, is there like a UV killing laundry detergent out there you can get?
Well, the first thing you do is you can buy laundry detergents that don't have that whitener and brightener.
Okay.
And then there are these different sprays you can use that are UV killers, which basically what they do is they take that light and
move it back in it,
undo what some of the whiteners and brighteners do.
Is that like
buy a camo pattern that doesn't have the brighteners in it and not worry about it, right?
Okay.
Just make sure you wash them clean.
You can buy one that's UV dead if the camo manufacturer knows the science and builds their product appropriately. You can buy one that's UV dead, but however, you can make that UV hot by washing it in a UV enhanced product. And again, what's the most common color of laundry detergent?
Blue.
That's for a reason, folks. again, since the 40s, that industry has learned how to move the reflectance of light on fabric from an area we don't see as well to one we see better to make it look brighter to our eye. All that's doing is making it much, much 20 times brighter to a deer because they already can see it in the spectrum that we don't see the difference in. They're already doing well there. And then all of a sudden you move it even further into that spectrum that they see better, you're just asking for trouble.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I feel like there's so many times I've gotten busted that makes sense now.
It's not always you.
All right. Well, let me mention just a couple more studies here that are just been completed. Some of them haven't even been published yet, but I had one student, Dr. Erin Watson, now she just graduated from the University of Tennessee with her doctorate, but she was on her master's down here. She actually uses those same deer training apparatuses to look at visual acuity, how well deer can see. Now, you can't get a deer to read an ABCD, you know, chart like in your eye doctor, but we use what's called spectral contrast sensitivity, where we could get them to look at grid patterns at different widths based on the distance they were, and as long as they could tell it was a grid versus a solid color, we knew that they were had the capability of seeing at least at that degree of specificity. And it turns out, after using the same treatments and doing it over and over again, deer have a visual acuity that's roughly equivalent to what we would have a 20/60 or 20/80 at a stationary object. At a stationary object, they almost have to have they'd almost have to have corrected lenses to get a driver's license. Think about it. Now, people think, well, no, deer have great vision. Well, yeah, they do, as soon as something moves. And you can stand out there dressed in pure black as stationary as a rock, and you're a rock. Which tells you something else about camel patterns then as well. A lot of these camel patterns have a lot of mimicry in them. They mimic leaves and stuff like that. Deer don't see that specificity. It doesn't need that. It needs more of the blocking patterns that kind of interrupt the outline of the animal, of the predator. It doesn't have to match the background as far as the design, but it has to interrupt the pattern. So they can't see the 2D outline, because that's what they're looking at, is 2D basically, whereas we can see in 3D. Hence the reason why Sitka has developed what they call the optophade, right? And that optophade, it has the micros and macros. It helps give it a little bit of that blending aspect and distort the outline.
Yeah, that's a really interesting piece of information about camo, because that's, I think maybe when Sitka came out with optophade was the first time that I'd heard that concept of like, okay, yeah, you're wearing this other camo pattern that's, you know, whatever. I mean, there's a lot of different ones out there, but what they're seeing is your outline. Or maybe because your outline is more pronounced, it's easier for them to catch your movement. Am I tracking that correctly?
No, you're both right there. And there's one other aspect of it as well. Well, let's get into that. So if you got camo, what is that camo designed to do? What's the camo supposed to do for you?
Break up your pattern.
It's supposed to do a couple things. First of all, it's supposed to help you remain undetected, right? First. And then if you are detected, you have to be unidentifiable. So it's got to do both of those things. So that undetection is based on a couple different things. One of them is movement. That's a hard one to camouflage against, right? But there are things that can be done, because if you can break up outline that matches the kind of the same blocking pattern as the background, it makes it harder to detect that movement somewhat. But the best camouflage as far as movement is concerned is don't move. You know, that's a pretty easy one. But then there's also the aspect of detection based on what we talked about earlier, is if there's something up there that's reflecting something very different as far as the spectral radiance of that camel versus the spectral radiance of the background, it's going to stand out like a sore thumb, right? And you're going to be able to see the outline based not on the shape of it, but based on the color of it. And if it's blue, the deer are going to see it very vividly. So all of a sudden, they not only see a blue thing up there, they see a blue human up there. And because it's blue, as soon as it moves against the background, it makes it much more vivid as far as motion is concerned. So designing something, which you said this isn't going to come out for a week or two?
Yeah, a couple weeks.
So I got to wear the hat right now. and that's what you have. The cover, camo just came out with one for the southeastern and eastern United States called Cover. And it's for hunting in kind of dense canopy situations. And when we developed that one, that's what we used as far as the science behind developing it, is to make sure it matched the spectral signature of the background, particularly at those two peaks, the blues and the yellows, where deer have their peak spectral sensitivity. So we tested a lot of their current camo, and we tested a lot of different prototypes of those different types of camo in hunting situations, in bottomland forests, upland forests, in field edges. We looked at them pre-dawn, post-dawn, pre-dusk, post-dusk. And we looked at for the pattern that came out that had the minimal difference between the background and the camo pattern. And the one that came out on top was one at the time we called B20. And it was almost a perfect match for us in most situations. so it matches the background right at the point where you have your peak spectral sensitivity. So that's the design behind cover, and it makes a lot of sense, right? So if you're matching the spectral of the background versus the spectral of the camel, once that moves, you're not seeing color movement, right? So it basically masks that movement based on color. And now with the Optifade design on top of it, that helps mask a little bit of the movement of the actual pattern. So that's the detection part of it. Now the identification part is also built on the same type of a system, right? You got to be able to break up that outline. When a deer looks up there, it has to identify you as a threat before it's going to flee, right? A lot of times a deer will look at you and try to figure out what you are. And if your pattern breaks up your outline very well, very hard for them to see that outline, unless that spectrum is different than the background. But if the spectrum is the same as the background, they really can't see the distinction between you and the background. And I've worn this camel. It's good. I'm not just selling this stuff because I do really believe the science behind it is very valid, that it's very difficult for a deer to decide what that is in that tree and whether that's a possible threat.
Mm-hmm. Also, I have a question too. You'll hear guys talk about, I've even heard guys talk about how a solid color or something like a flannel or something like that is better than a camo because going to the movement part, maybe an older school traditional camo pattern, again, kind of outlines you a little bit more, but maybe if you're wearing a solid color, it's harder for them to pick up because there's not, I don't know, harsh lines running through it. I don't really understand the rationale behind it, but I'm wondering your thoughts on that, or on if is like an earth tone solid color, assuming that you're good with all your UV brighteners and whiteners and everything that's not in there. How does that stack up against maybe a cheaper camo pattern?
I don't know quite how to answer that that question. There's a lot of, if you have a solid color, obviously you're going to be able to see the outline of that color. I mean, of that object, and it would make it easier. I think something that had a blockier style to it would be much more valid, where you had, you know, large blotches of different colors, as long as they match the background as well, because that kind of obscures the outline. The identification of a human or a predator by a deer is based on its perception of what that outline is. And if you can obscure that outline, it makes it harder for them to identify. And it also make it harder for them to pick up movement as well. And it may look more like even a branch moving when a squirrel jumps on it, you know. So
I think in a blind situation, for example, you know, a black, you know, a lot of hunters that hunt in ground blinds and things in particular wear black clothing. I think that's ideal. Because if your background's black, you're blending in better than putting on a camo pattern that doesn't fit in that environment, particularly if that camo pattern has different context and shape and color. You know, you're going to get busted way quicker wearing camo in a ground blind than you are as long as your background is dark, right? So I would agree with that strategy in general for sure. And heck, the old red and black plaid hunting coats of the 70s is actually quite good camo. Based on what we know deer can see, that red, that because of their inability to see into those long wavelength colors, you know, the red, they're not seeing the red as we see it, you know, so they're, you know, it's not as good as some of the modern camos perhaps, but it's not bad compared. And the other thing is the fabric itself. We haven't talked about that. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people say, well, blaze orange isn't bad. Well, that's true. As a general rule of concept, they don't see it as blaze orange, but if you're wearing a $299 plastic vest that's reflecting light off the material, not the color, the material, then that's a problem. It's just like the glare off a gun barrel duck hunting, right? You know, there's certain things that are different than the color. It's the reflectance of light.
Fabric, that what we call surface flash,
yes,
is very important as well. And doing something with have the fabric appropriate that is not reflecting from the surface, because you get two reflectance off of any fabric. You get the reflectance of the color that it's not absorbing, right? And then you also get a flash off the surface. Well, there's certain things like Berbers and stuff like that are not going to have that same type of flash as something like a nylon would. You know, nylon's going to have a very good flash on it. So you make sure you choose that camo appropriately, because when you get that white flash, what is that white flash? That's flash is reflecting all the colors of the spectrum that are available at that time, including at dark or dusk, the blues again. So they get a blink of blue up there, you know. So keep, you know, consider the fabric of the camo you're buying as well.
Is there like a type of fabric where someone could go look in their closet right now and look and see if they have like one of the bad kinds?
I mean,
like,
you can
read the tag and see what it is.
I mean, you can take it out and look out, you know, put it in the sunlight or put a flashlight on. You can see that reflectance off of it.
Okay. Yeah. So while I can't see something like Blaze Orange, the fabric might just kind of show up better for them, like glow.
Yeah. And where it's legal, I mean, you know, it's still a big block of unbroken color. So it may not see it as orange, but a big Blaze Orange vest with just straight orange,
yeah,
it's probably easier to detect because it's an abnormal shape of the same. So they won't be seeing the color, but they may be seeing something different on you. So it's not legal in every state, but if you had the luxury of camo Blaze Orange or something like that, it would be slightly better.
By the way, could y'all clarify, Carl, maybe you can do this. How do deer perceive Blaze Orange and reds? Like what color spectrum? Since they can't see that spectrum, what is it?
Well, they
resemble
can,
to them?
They can see in this part of the spectrum.
Okay.
But it's not near at the peak of their spectral sensitivity. It's further out of their sensitivity. Like I said, as we see deeper and deeper into the reds, it gets darker and darker, right, into black. It starts to do that into the oranges and the reds with deer. So this is not going to be near as vivid to a deer as it is to a human.
Okay. So it's not like it's going to be gray or anything to them, just a more dull color?
Yeah, remember, find somebody that's red-green colorblind and ask them that question, you know. But those things further out on the spectrum, like the reds and the greens, are harder for them to distinguish between. And particularly in the fall when there's a lot of oranges out there as well, that's not much different than leaf color, you know. So this matches relatively good. Blue doesn't.
Yeah, you know, back to Carl's comment about red-green colorblindness in humans, you know, we think deer are pretty similar. So if you had a ripe tomato on a green vine, they couldn't distinguish by color, okay? And the same would, if you put a Blaze Orange hat in there, it would be hard for them to pick that out of that same general group of colors, right? It would blend those together much more similarly than ours. And it's also important to keep in mind that color is something that we have defined. We call things colors. Mm-hmm. It's just reflectance of light, right?
Reflectance of different wavelengths.
Different right? wavelengths of light. So we have to always be careful of calling something. We call it a color. Well, it is because that's what we call it, but it's not exactly a color. it's a wavelength of light, right? So how we perceive it and what we call it is very different than how a deer or these other species that are dichromats would see the world. It's different. It's not necessarily good, better or worse.
Let me clarify something about the UV as well. It's clear that from our testing, the deer can see further into what we call the ultraviolet. That means ultraviolet means we don't see it, right? And it's somewhere around 400 nanometers or less. They can see further down than that. But that does not mean that they see ultraviolet as a glow. Like Brian said, not under a black light. Because there's not many but black lights out there in the woods, right? Think about it. When we see blues, and as the blues get deeper and deeper, further down the wavelength, they turn to purples, they turn to violet, and they turn to black, and you don't see them near well. Well, that happens further down the spectrum with deer. So they see, as they go down into those ultraviolets, they become less and less.
One thing we talk about with almost every guest on this show is map scouting. My favorite map scouting tool is LIDAR. If you're unfamiliar, LIDAR is basically like a 3D scan of the Earth's surface. I like to say it kind of takes away all the surprises. LIDAR is now available on Onyx Hunt on their topography map. If you go to your app right now, click on the topography map, you can flip on that LIDAR feature and boom, it's gonna come on and you're gonna see what I'm talking about. The LIDAR is gonna allow you to see things that are normally hidden from view. This might be ditches, bends in creeks, rocks, old roadbeds. I personally love old roadbeds because deer like to walk them. They're great places to find scrapes. They're great camera locations. And you know, before, an old roadbed or an old logging road might be something that you kind of happen upon while you're out scouting or hunting. Well, now with the LIDAR, before I go into an area, I can turn on that LIDAR and I can see exactly where those roadbeds are. Even old logging roads from the 1930s, you can still see them on there. So that allows me to go straight to those spots and check them out. It's just an incredibly helpful tool, and it's available now on Onyx Hunt. And hey, if you want to get 20% off your Onyx Elite membership, you can use the promo code Southern. Like I said, it's going to save you 20%. Go check out that LIDAR feature. You'll be glad you did. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt.
If you're traveling to hunt this fall, you need to check out Outdoorsy. Outdoorsy is the most trusted RV rental marketplace in the U.S., making it easy for anyone to rent an RV or a camper without owning one. I'm going to be honest with you guys. I wish I knew about this sooner. There's been a couple hunts over these last few years where, you know, depending on where you're going to hunt, there might not be good hotel options. There might not be good rental house options. So, I mean, this is perfect for the traveling hunter. They've got thousands of RVs and campers nationwide available right in your neighborhood. You got multiple ways that you can travel. You can drive it yourself, you can tow it, or you can have it delivered and fully set up at your destination. Outdoorsy also has built-in peace of mind. They've got comprehensive insurance, 24/7 customer support, and roadside assistance included. So not only is this a good option to give you a good place to stay even when you're going somewhere pretty remote to go hunting, but it's also often more affordable than hotels, especially if you got a good group of guys going with you. So how it works is you just search and choose an RV that fits your trip and your group size, you book it with confidence, and then you hit the road, whether you're driving, towing, or getting it delivered. And right now, listeners of the Southern Outdoorsman podcast can have all service fees removed from their booking in 2026 with show code OUTDOORSMAN at outdoorsy.com. That's OUTDOORSY.com, and use the code OUTDOORSMAN at checkout to remove all service fees.
One thing we talk about with almost every guest on this show is map scouting. My favorite map scouting tool is LiDAR. If you're unfamiliar, LiDAR is basically like a 3D scan of the Earth's surface. I like to say it kind of takes away all the surprises. LiDAR is now available on Onyx Hunt on their topography map. If you go to your app right now, click on the topography map, you can flip on that LiDAR feature and boom, it's going to come on and you're going to see what I'm talking about. The LiDAR is going to allow you to see things that are normally hidden from view. This might be ditches, bends in creeks, rocks, old roadbeds. I personally love old roadbeds because deer like to walk them. They're great places to find scrapes. They're great camera locations. And you know, before, an old roadbed or an old logging road might be something that you kind of happen upon while you're out scouting or hunting. Well, now with the LiDAR, before I go into an area, I can turn on that LiDAR and I can see exactly where those roadbeds are. Even old logging roads from the 1930s, you can still see them on there. So that allows me to go straight to those spots and check them out. It's just an incredibly helpful tool, and it's available now on Onyx Hunt. And hey, if you want to get 20% off your Onyx Elite membership, you can use the promo code Southern. Like I said, it's going to save you 20%. Go check out that LiDAR feature. You'll be glad you did. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt.
Less vivid to them. Although they can still see color there, it does not mean that they glow. The point of where you're glowing is where you're at their peak of their spectral sensitivity, is back into the blues. And then that speaks to what Brian was saying about those brighteners and brighteners that move in that UV into the visible part of the range, what we call the visible part of the range.
Gotcha. Okay. I have a question that I don't know. It might be kind of a dumb question, but I'm very curious about how their depth perception, how they just perceive the world and movement and everything, how it might affect someone who's maybe interested in hunting off the ground, and maybe they're not using a pop-up blind. Maybe they're brushing in a natural blind. Based on what you've learned about how deer perceive their environment, is there a right or a wrong way to brush in yourself? You know, front cover, back cover, all the above, all that good stuff. Look, I just piqued his interest. So.
Yeah, just get under a brush pile, man.
Climb up in a slash pile and you're good to go.
Obviously, at that point, with the brush pile, the biggest challenge is going to be concealing motion versus concealing concealment, right? So how are you going to set that up to conceal the motion? Being behind something makes it a lot easier than concealing in front of something, right? So you need to have a lot more concealment in the front aspect of it. But you also got to make sure you don't have where you can have a distinct movement in the backgrounds so they can see you with the background moving behind it. If the whole thing moves as one, it's harder for them to distinguish.
And keep in mind, as Carl already pointed out, the way a deer's eye is built very specifically is detecting predators on the horizon, which a ground blind is. Tree stand, you definitely have an advantage. They don't normally look up for predators. They will. Mm-hmm. We've all been busted in trees. They will look up, but it's not their natural inclination because most of their threats come from the ground. And so ground hunters have to be even more sensitive to movement than a tree stand hunter. You can get away with more in a tree. We've all done it. You know, and particularly if a deer is distracted, you know, and the same with jumping, so-called jumping the string or ducking the arrow, whatever you want to call it. You know, a deer that's wound up is going to be much more likely to react negatively and avoid, you know, than one that's calm. So a lot of it is watching the deer's behavior and you know, taking that right time to move when you have the opportunity. Because
that's actually a very critical thing to think about when your deer's looking with his vision. There's a ton of information coming in through a deer's eyes, and they can only process so much at a time. But they can focus on that processing as well. That is, you know, if they're just walking along and scanning their environment, they're just looking for movement and stuff like that. But as soon as they detect something, they can put all their analytical energy, basically, you know, put all their brain power at analyzing what that particular thing is and not and kind of ignore the rest of it. So that it gives them more ability to process that type of information once you're busted. So it's more important not to get busted first.
So you're saying that they can get distracted like humans and kind of forget about things for a moment. And that's obviously what we all look for as hunters, right? You know, you're sitting there with a deer in bow range and you're waiting for that magic moment to draw your bow. And finally, something else in the forest gets their attention and they lock onto something else and you've got them dead to rights then, right? Because they're completely focused on something else. And for that millisecond, that's your draw opportunity. But other than that, a deer that's on edge walking through that knows something's there, if you try to draw on that deer, 9 times out of 10, you're busted.
Yeah.
You better to wait it out until you get that moment. And even if they walk past you out to maximum of your bow range anyway, than to try to draw with one that's wired. Because if they're wired, all their senses are at full alert, and that 310 degrees, keeping you in focus the whole time, you know, ears wide open, rotating those. I mean, you've got every alarm bell going in the world at that point.
Another thing to keep in mind as far as tree stand hunting, too, is the angle that you're approaching. I mean, if you're 20, 25 feet up in a tree and the deer's right under you, there's no way they can see you. But if that deer's standing out there 30 yards, you're still getting into the sweet spot where you're reflecting off that band on their retina.
That's a really interesting point. And that kind of goes back more so in the scent, but I know a lot of guys growing up that older guys, like some of my uncles and people that, you know, they were hunting a lot in the 70s and 80s about before anyone was ever discussing scent control is climb as physically high as you can get in a tree, specifically talking gun hunting. And, you know, you're just out of line of sight and hopefully your scent is drifting past them or above them, whatever, especially with thermals. You have some kind of advantage in that circumstance.
That's the big thing. There's so much movement of wind in the forest between upward thermals and downward thermals in morning and evening and eddies and so forth. It's pretty hard if the wind's moving at any to mask your scent. The best thing is to be downwind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just hunt smart.
Mm-hmm. I've got another question, too. I mean, it could be hunting in trees, but also ground hunting. When it comes to somebody wanting to break up their outline using something like a ghillie suit or a leaf suit, how important is camo pattern specifically for that when, you know, you're hopefully, I guess the thought process behind it is your outline is literally being disrupted by the material
itself.
You
have no outline anymore.
Okay.
Right.
So it could be like black. It could be solid black.
A ghillie suit is great. Other than if it's black, you're going to be able to pick up the motion of that solid color, right?
Okay.
Versus something that's got a lot more edge to it.
Okay.
And just make sure it doesn't have any difference in reflectance of the spectrum as well. So it's the shape of it, but it's also the spectral reflectance.
Okay. I gotcha.
But a ghillie suit is a great camo.
Oh, yeah. We're going to use them this year. We're fired up. Okay, so do you have anything else on site right now?
Is there anything else we're missing on site?
Yeah.
Any other studies or anything else that y'all are looking to potentially, or anyone else is potentially trying to look into deer vision?
Yeah, we have. And this is just a hint of some data that we have. But we have another student, she's just finished up some stuff at UGA, Dr. Blaze Newman. And one of the things that she did was she looked at deer's movements through their environment based on the spectral availability in that environment at different times of the day. Because a forested situation versus an open situation versus a where you got a patchy situation can have a very different availability of different parts of the spectrum. And she found that basically they tended to avoid moving through parts of parts of their environment where there was a lot of spectral reflectance, particularly into the blue part of the spectrum. I think it was into the blue part. I'd have to remember. Here I'm talking out of my, you know what? The bottom line is that their movements through the environment is reflective of some of the light availability in that environment. Now, obviously, if they're going to feed in certain places, they have to go through different environments, but there is a little bit of selectivity. There are some places they would rather go than other than not, based on the spectral reflectance.
Was there any examples that she, like, what examples did she find that they were kind of avoiding because of that?
I'd have to go back and reread that.
Now you left us with a cliffhanger.
Now we're quizzing you.
Yeah, this was done down in Florida. So this has to be repeated. I'm just throwing this out there as a hint that there might be something. The deer are making selection of the habitat use that they use based partially on light availability.
Okay.
That it's one of their considerations. Now, obviously, food availability and predator avoidance are the top two, but the light spectrum might have some impact on it as well.
Okay, very interesting. I'm trying to think, when it comes to deer vision, I don't know how applicable this would be, but if a deer gets an eye injured, like we've all had trail cam photos of like a one-eyed buck, you know, got an eye poked out. With a deer with one eye, I mean, I can't imagine how much harder it is for him to live and try to survive. But would anything change? Of course, how much they can perceive, you know, vision around them, you know, that 310 degrees would get cut down in half.
Right.
But is there anything else, like when it comes to like eye injuries or anything like that, that could be prone to like other issues or like, is there any kind of diseases or anything that affects it?
Not really. You know, what deer loss and eye would lose some of that binocular vision, you know, which helps you with depth perception, but they don't have a fovea centralis like we do, so they don't have as good a depth perception to begin with. So with one eye, you know, a deer just turns its head, and it could probably accommodate for that as well just by, you know, looking in that direction where his other eye used to be. So I don't think a one-eyed deer would have that much of a problem.
Okay. Now, there's examples of blind deer that have survived. I mean, so, and, you know, yeah, I think a one-eyed deer would survive at nearly equal rates. Obviously, it's more subject to predation, getting ambushed from one of its blind spots. But in general, I think it would be a fairly nominal challenge for a whitetail.
Okay.
I think they can move. One-eyed humans, you know, we can just move our head a lot more. We're still seeing the world as long as one eye's good, mm-hmm. one kidney's good. You know, I mean, you know.
that's why God designed us with duplicity, you know.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Always got a spare.
So I'll tell you one unique thing about deer vision that's kind of cool. Doesn't affect vision, but I've only actually personally seen one and photographed it, a doe with amber-colored eyes. Deer have dark-colored eyes. Mm. One in so many tens of thousands have this beautiful amber, light brown, chestnut-colored eye, and they look like devils. I mean, they really look different. So if you see one, you've catch yourself lucky. They're rare, but they're really cool.
Oh, here's another cool thing. You know how deer have their head pointed like this, or their eyes have a slit on the horizon. What happens when the deer puts its head down? That slit. No. They have a process called cycloversion, where as they put their head down, that eye stays level.
Whoa.
It turns in their head.
Really? So they can maintain that horizon?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah. And
that's wild. Okay.
So even when a deer's got its heads down, it's looking not at the ground, it's looking out.
That is fascinating. Interesting. I thought you were going to say that they can see up and down better, and that's why I get busted drawing on them all the time.
They're that feature. You're going to do these that water. Yeah. Catching you. Oh, man. So is there anything else that we're missing on deer vision? Because, like, there's a lot of information, but it's really, I feel like, very applicable for someone to have a better perspective of what their capabilities actually are, especially after some of the research. Mm-hmm. Is there any other like data points or anything that you found interesting, especially through some of the studies?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of anything else that'd be appropriate at this time. There's still so much we don't know, obviously. And it's obviously we can't get inside a deer's head to determine exactly what they're seeing. What everything I've told you is our best guess at what the data interpreted as, you know, that what we think is going on when we get the data. So there's still a lot more to learn, obviously, particularly as it relates to what part of the spectrum they can see and how they utilize their environment and how they utilize their sight for everything they do.
You mentioned that, you know, when you got into the field, you were interested in learning more about deer so you could get better at hunting them. How are you using this information you've gathered? I mean, obviously you helped design your own camo pattern with Sitka. So that's one thing that I know you've done. But like, is there anything else just on a personal level that it has impacted your hunting from this information that you've learned?
From the deer's aspect, other than don't wear blues, I used to wear blues religiously to the stand.
Wear some blue jeans.
Yeah, don't be wearing blues. Watch your movements. I think one of the biggest things that I've learned, and not necessarily related to vision, but it's related to how you enter and leave a stand, what you do in a stand, and every interaction you ever have with a deer. Because every interaction you ever have with a deer, you've just taught that deer something. And I think that's important to keep in mind, particularly with people who have repetitive use of same stands and so forth. Every behavior that a deer has is a learned behavior. They're not naturally avoiding humans until they learn. You know, they're taught to avoid humans. And they're taught by, and mainly is taught by experience. And the more you give them that experience, the smarter you're going to make your deer, and you're making them not use certain areas as well.
Has there been any studies done specifically on like a deer's mental capacity for like memory or anything like that? Again, like when it comes to, like, conditioning or anything, like kind of what you're talking about, like they're kind of like
classical conditioning.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Maybe there has been, but I can report a study done at Chesapeake Farms in Maryland that looked at deer movements in relation. And it's been done many times. Been done in Georgia. Deer's use of a landscape that has permanent hunting stands that are hunted frequently, and yes, they absolutely avoid them at a significantly statistical rate. Mm-hmm. That. In fact, the Georgia study was done just south of where we're talking today a few years ago, you know, literally looked at over 100 food plots, box stands on over 100 food plots versus those that weren't, and saw, you know, the daytime use of those food plots just plummet during the season versus the unhunted ones that stayed pretty active. And literally it got so bad that if you were hunting one of the over 100 food plot box stands, you literally could throw a dart on the map anywhere on that property and have a statistically higher chance of killing a deer than going to that box stand.
And that's not the only study that has shown that exact same
thing.
That's
what I'm saying. It's been shown in multiple.
One of the first studies was done at Westerville over in Alabama where they did that same type of thing.
They showed the heat maps.
Right. And we did one in West Central Georgia where during the breeding season, these bucks absolutely avoided feeders. I mean, everybody was worried because baiting became legal, all the big bucks are going to get killed. Now, those big bucks got big because they got a little wiser, right? And they avoided a lot of those bait stations. They might go by those bait stations a ways downwind, check them out to see if some of the does have gone in there, but they would, same type of situation, the worst place on that property. And it was almost an unhunted property, very, very lightly hunted property, but the worst place would have been over a feeder or a food plot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty bad when you can throw a dart on a map. And how many of us have experienced that situation? We got a novice hunter that knows nothing about the property, goes out and randomly sits in the woods and kills a big buck, right?
Or they're trying to gar hole some kid at the club.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know?
We're going to put him in that spot because nobody sees anything there because nobody's ever gone there.
Yeah.
Think about what that's telling a deer, you know. So there's many places right behind camp.
Right behind the pinout board.
Yeah, right. I mean, how many times has that happened over the years to folks? And so, yeah, there's no question that deer can learn your behavior if you that behavior.
Go ahead.
No, keep going.
I just got a thought that a question a lot of times I get. They say, what kind of color light should I use when I'm walking into my stand?
Ooh.
I don't think it matters. Deer aren't afraid of light. How many get hit by vehicles with these great big lights coming at them? You know, I mean, it's not that they're running away from light. They don't run from lightning bugs. They don't run from lightning. They don't run from street lights. You know, that deer are not inherently afraid of light. So I don't think it really matters. I would use a dimmer light when I walk in. I don't worry about what I use. We know that they can see blues real well, so probably in the reds if you're really worried about it. They have no concept that of a light moving through the woods that there's a 180-pound human behind it carrying a weapon. They don't know that. All they see is that light. It's the same reason that they see on the side of the road. They're looking. They don't know that there's a ton of vehicle metal behind that light because all they see is the light getting bigger like this. So unless you teach them somehow through walking in, making a lot of noise, of course, with your cadence and stuff like that, that they can tell, you know, that you're something different, the light's not the appropriate, the important thing. It's being quiet and try to be scent free walking in there.
I was going to say scent free. I'm convinced that if you condition a deer with that light is equal to the smell of a human, then I think there can be a learned behavior there. I prefer not to use a light if I can do it. Just maybe I'm over cautious there, but I agree that light in general may not be the problem, but I don't want to condition a deer to anything that I don't have to.
You know, I used to coon hunt a lot when I was in college, and I'd be out in the woods obviously at nighttime a lot, and sometimes when the dog's singing on a cold trail or something like that, I'd walk up on a deer, and there's times when I got behind that deer and carrying a light with me, these bright lights, I could walk right behind that deer as the deer's walking through the woods, and it had no care that I was behind it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So one thing y'all just mentioned, kind of this little segment we were talking about when it comes to like conditioning deer and them avoiding permanent stand locations. What advice would you have for, especially, you know, specifically the private land guys, whether it's a hunting club, a lease, or property they own, about working around that situation with the permanent stands, as in if deer started avoiding them? Like, what is your thoughts, like, based on, or both y'all's thoughts based on that data from, again, a private land manager's perspective?
Well, the Westervelt study that was referenced earlier, and you guys have some Westervelt ground, so it's apropos, but, you know, they looked at where the hunters hunted most often and created heat maps of hunter activity and then overlaid that with deer movement and deer harvest, and the brightest areas of human activity were some of the lowest areas of harvest and deer engagements, right? If we go to if we do the same things over and over, eventually those are going to not play out. The reverse of that, though, is the concept that you can never kill a big deer on a food plot in a box stand. That's absolutely false. Okay, if you strategically hunt those food sources at the right time and right places and are careful, you can hunt box stands, permanent stands, and kill big deer all the time. You just can't hunt them over and over and over and condition deer that's a source of a problem. And that's hard to do on a hunt club situation unless you have some sort of limiting factor that, you know, a stand can only get hunted, you know, once a week or once every 2 weeks or something that prevents that just continual pounding of that same area. And the other thing is, you know, you're driving these noisy four-wheelers often right up to 100 yards from the stand. You're conditioning deer. You know, you're doing a lot of things else. And what do we do? And this was a study done, just released a few years ago, in I think it was done in Mississippi, that looked at how long it takes a deer. They looked at the traditional Friday, Saturday, Sunday hunting scenario where a group of guys piling on the property on Friday, run around in the four-wheelers and UTVs, checking feeders, cameras, whatever, hunt Saturday, Sunday, and go home. They found that it takes, on average, 48-plus hours minimum for a deer to regain its normal behavioral pattern after that weekend disturbance. So they found that statistically, your best chances of killing a deer on any given property that is historically weekend hunted is Wednesday and Thursday of the week. You have a statistically higher chance of killing a deer on Wednesday and Thursday before the Friday crowd gets in and after the disturbance from the previous Sunday. Deer have returned to a normal behavior on average by 3 days after the last disturbance. So if you can hunt midweek, that statistically speaking, you have a greater chance of harvesting a deer.
Yeah, and consider the food plot as well and the hunting conditions. I mean, if the wind's not right, don't hunt it. You know, only hunt it where you know where the deer are going to approach from upwind. Consider your access to that, to and from the stand, particularly as you're leaving the stand in the evening. Make sure you have a place where you can get down and get out of sight before the deer, you get busted from the stand. You know, have your food plots, your stands don't have to be out in the middle of the food plot. They can be tucked into a corner or something like that where you can actually sneak away without disturbing any deer that might be in the field that you may not decide not to take or might not even have seen.
Or better yet, have somebody in a vehicle come bust the deer off for you. At least they have, you know, a vehicle driving in, busting the deer off your plots better than you crawling out and having all the deer watch you walk across the field back to your car, you know. So you can't always do that if you don't have anybody hunting with you. But if you can, if you can't get out, like Carl said, best thing is, and I've seen it over and over, people putting these box stands or permanent stands right on the food plot or in the food plot, even worse, out in the middle of the food plot. It's like, most of these are evening hunts. Mm-hmm. Most of the time you're going to have deer on the field unless you shoot. Mm-hmm. So you're almost guaranteeing to pattern those deer against you.
Yep.
I mean, just by how you set up that stand. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like guys on Andrew's club. You know, he's got some guys in his club.
Yeah, you say they drive 100 yards? No. How about 7 yards?
I mean, literally park the truck or four-wheeler and then step out onto the box stand, climb up in it or get inside of it, and that's how they hunt.
Yeah,
and
man.
And they also, some of them leave. It's almost like they're scared of the dark. They leave that last 15 minutes of light.
At the bewitching hour, right?
And yeah. Dude, they are getting in their vehicles and they're driving back to camp. And it's like, gosh. So, and then they wonder why I don't kill anything on the food plots. Plus, the food plots are real small, too. I mean, like quarter acre or less on some of those plots. And it's like, you know, it's tough in that circumstance. That was one thing. We brought that up with Bronson Strickland when we interviewed him. And he mentioned, like, some of the clients that they've worked with or some of the people they've worked with specifically that had the most success killing mature bucks on food plots were doing either one or two things. Like, Brian, like what you were saying, they hunt it very sparingly, like it's timed at a very specific point when they hunt it, and then after that they don't hunt a whole bunch. Or they set up where they are specifically gun hunting, where they can shoot 100-plus yards into the food plot, where they're way back off the food plot, up a roadbed, way in the woods, and they cut lanes where they can shoot way up into it, but then they can slip out, and they're not close enough to be able to be seen or heard by those deer in the plot.
Most of our stands on my hunting property employ both of those two strategies. You have to shoot through the forest before you even get into the field. That gives us a great back door, and we hunt them very sparingly, and we kill a lot of mature, fully mature bucks on those food plots. But we wouldn't if we hunted them like a traditional hunt club hunts them. Sticks them out in the wrong spot, overhunts them, lets deer bust them frequently, you know. But those two simple things can make permanent stands almost unpatternable. Because you're not giving deer a consistent pattern enough to make it a pattern. You know, you're almost as random in the woods as you are in those food plots at that point.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a really good point. One thing I want to bring up, because I know we have a few minutes left before we got to wrap up this episode, because we're on a time crunch a little bit here. But, Carl, could you talk a little bit about deer hearing? We kind of mentioned that before we started recording earlier. Like, there's some stuff there worth talking about.
Yeah, and there's been relatively few studies that have been done on that. Actually, there have been two good ones that have been done. One was done by, again, Dr. Gino D'Angelo when he was working on his master's here, where he used what is called an electroatenneogram. What the heck was the name of it? Anyways.
we don't know what it is. Don't
look at me.
What it did, it monitored the deer. You know, on a sedated deer, it monitored the deer's brain waves in response to different sounds that were played into the deer's ear. And patterned it out basically, and looked at what part of this, what frequency they would hear the best, and what the range of frequencies was, and that gave us an idea of physiologically what their capability was. But that study, in combination with a study that was done with a behavioral study, that was done up at the University of Toledo by a father-son team by the name of Hefner and Hefner, where they trained deer to respond just like we did in the deer pens to respond when they heard a sound. Just like Pavlov's dog, and they would get a reward from that. And they developed what is called a behavioral audiogram. And both of them matched each other quite well. And it turns out that deer hearing is not that much different than ours. Mm-hmm. Well, no,
with some exceptions.
With some exceptions. But isn't that, I mean, it's surprising. They hear in the higher frequencies a little bit better. But they don't hear these, you know, you've seen these deer whistles and stuff that people have used. Years ago, people put them
on the trucks or whatever.
Yeah, it was a big rave at one time, you know. And these deer whistles, deer can't even hear that. Even if they made a sound, deer couldn't hear that. And there's a whole other aspects behind that we can get into. But their hearing is about the same range as ours and about the same acuity as ours, which is kind of interesting because everybody thinks, you know, I know that deer heard me and stuff like that. Their hearing must be great. But the difference is a deer knows what it's supposed to hear in the woods and it doesn't know what it's supposed to hear in the woods. And, you know, when we're sitting on a stand, we hear a noise in the woods. We turn around, look at it. Is that a squirrel? We turn around, you know, what is that? You know, a deer hears a squirrel running through the woods. It doesn't even pick up its head. They know that sound that it's supposed to be, and they know what's not supposed to be there. So that's the biggest difference is we're in their bedroom. They're not in our bedroom. If you dropped a nickel on your kitchen floor, you'd probably be able to identify that as a nickel being dropped on your kitchen floor, right? Because we're used to those sounds. We don't live in the woods 24/7 like a deer does.
Yeah, of course, they can directionalize much better, right?
I was going to ask about being able to turn their ears.
And so they can definitely, you know, gather more sound and directionalize it better than we can. Mm-hmm. One of the big take homes there, I think, is understanding the difference between low frequency sound and high frequency sound. So in the human's world, in any world, low frequency sounds are these low tonal sounds. We're talking about foghorns, talking about train whistles, these loud, low sounds. They travel through the environment further. They're denser, heavier sound, if you will. High frequency sounds, you know, things like metal, you know, arrow hitting on a rest, that's a high frequency sound. That's like a 22 bullet. It comes out fast but dies quickly in the environment. The other's more like a shotgun blast, low tonal sounds. So the sounds that you have to avoid are unnatural sounds, and often it's those higher frequency sounds that are the most abnormal. You know, the tinks and the dings and the things that aren't the normal woods type sounds, because a lot of those other sounds are more tonal. I know you want to interject here somewhere.
Yeah, but you were talking about the directionality. That's the one caveat to throw in here. Mm-hmm. Deer have these external ears, large ears called pinnae, and it gives them a couple of aspects. That, you know, one is it helps funnel sound into it. That actually increases their vision, their hearing ability. So we were looking at their hearing ability right at the ear. This actually provides more of those wavelengths into those frequencies into the deer's mm-hmm. ear, and it also helps them directionalize as well, because they're on the further out you are, the better it is for directionalizing something, because the way you directionalize it is the difference between those sounds coming in one ear versus another ear, and the further out you are, the greater your ability to directionalize it. But that does come with a caveat, though. When a deer has its ears turned towards an object, it hears less from behind it. So it gives up something for that directionality as well. So that's why deer have the ability to do this. You know, turn one ear, turn the other ear. You know, they can look in all directions because they're trying to gather information from different parts of their environment, which we can't really conceptualize. We can't understand, you know.
One thing that's, I think, also important is that while the general range and intensity of sounds that deer can hear is not that much different than ours, they're in tune with their environment better. And so what I mean by that is if you talk to a blind person, their hearing is no better than mine, but it's finally adapted because they've had to from a survival standpoint. They hear things that I don't hear. And so what I do early in the deer season, I don't hear as well as I do later in the deer season. And I think all hunters realize that, if not subconsciously, that as you train yourself to listen and to separate normal sounds from abnormal sounds, and I actually practice it. I sit in the deer stand and think about it and try to separate every sound I can, and with my eyes shut, thinking about what I'm hearing. And as the season progresses, I become a better predator. My predatory skill improves as the season goes. I become more attuned with my environment. My hearing improves. My sight ability to pick up movement gets better. I'm training myself. Deer does it every day of its life. Mm-hmm. We only do it seasonally as hunters. But if you think about it, you become better with your eyes and your ears, and not as much with our nose. Our noses are a joke compared to a deer's. But but certainly our eyes and our hearing can definitely improve with the season if you will train yourself and think about it. It's a trained skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that you mentioned is the deer know what they're supposed to hear in the woods. And I'm curious if y'all have ever done this. But one thing that I've started doing in the last, I've probably been doing about 10 years now, is if I just cannot be quiet walking to my stand, I'll just yelp like a turkey every once in a while. And oh my gosh, does that work good? Like, that works real. I think it's because like a turkey is such a, like, everything eats a turkey, right? And they're very skittish animals, you know? So I think if they hear like a turkey sound, they're like, okay. And also we walk on 2 feet, turkey walks on 2 feet. So that's worked really well for me, because it's always hard. You know, if we don't have a predetermined path to our stand, like if I'm not going to a permanent blind or anything, and I'm bushwhacking to get to a new area on some public land or something, sometimes you just cannot be quiet. You mm-hmm. know, you just have to bust through some brush. But that's worked well for me. I don't know if y'all have ever tried that before. But.
Also, another thing you could do is pay attention to what a deer's cadence sounds like versus a human's cadence. Mm-hmm. A deer's cadence is four legs, right? Ours is... you know, coming into a stand. And deer can tell the difference in that as well. And I have at times, I've had the experience a couple of times, especially when I was doing my research up in the mountains, I would have a stick with me, you know, and I would kind of mimic that four-step beat. A couple of times I've had, during the rut, I've had bucks come running towards me because they thought that might be another doe that, you know, that I need to check out. So, I mean, they can identify, you know, potential predator or a potentially other deer by their ears as well.
Interesting. Man, we're running super short on time here.
I got one last thing. I know we just got a couple minutes.
I want to make one point about grunt calls while we're talking about hearing.
Okay.
So the two studies Carl referenced, there was one other done, Texas A&M, that all looked at deer hearing and all came up with the same results that we've shared. But they did, one of them did test the frequency that the average grunt call makes and found it to be right in the peak sensitivity of a whitetail. And you'll know that I mentioned the difference between low frequency and high frequency sounds. A grunt call is a low frequency sound. It travels in the environment further than a high pitched sound. So a grunt call, when you make it, goes further in the environment because of its frequency, and it's right in the peak hearing sensitivity of a whitetail. So grunt calls are very specific for their tonality as well as the volume. So don't be afraid to get on it a little bit, but also know that your call is going further in the environment than you probably think it is.
Yeah, that's like you calling so quiet last year, right?
Like, yeah, I love calling. Love calling deer. It's like you don't have to be as loud as you think you have to.
Correct.
I'm going to add one more thing. Another thing that's right in the peak of the deer's hearing ability is this. The brushing up of the fabric against the tree your brushing of your fabric. So, again, it comes back to fabric as well. Choose your fabric accordingly as well. If your fabric is really noisy, that's right in their sweet spot to hear. Several years ago, I worked with Sitka, and we redesigned their Fanatic system based on deer hearing. And we reduced that engagement distance, what we call the engagement distance, how far a deer could hear that before it attenuated, what we're talking about, it disappeared, that a deer could hear it. And we reduced that by about, 20 or 30 yards. So minimizing that sound is, again, critical. It's particularly in that part of the deer's range where their hearing capability is best.
And the human voice also, typically, particularly male voices, we've all had experienced this, where you've got often a female or a child that has a lighter, squeakier voice that doesn't travel very far, right? Somebody with a dark, deeper voice like me or louder voice, it's going to travel farther in the environment.
Way further. Have you been in the woods? I've been in the woods so many times, and also I hear these two guys talking. I'm like, where?
You feel like they're like right in your back pocket.
It happened to me last year. Some guys came in with a coon dog. I think it was coon dog. I don't know, but they were 250 yards, and they're just talking, and it sounds like they are on top of me. And they weren't even like screaming loud, but they have that real deep voice.
Yeah, and it carries.
Well, and that speaks, we'll get back to these deer whistles on the side that people put on their vehicles. They're supposed to make a sound in a ultra high frequency. Well, the thing that we're talking about is called attenuation. And these very high frequencies get attenuated very, very fast, these really high pitched things. So for that to adjust, adapt to that attenuation, for that deer whistle to make a sound loud enough to project in front of that vehicle at 60 miles an hour, it would have to be so loud it would shatter every window in that vehicle. and besides, most of them work in a passive way where the air going through it causes the sound to come out of the back. So even if a deer heard that, a deer would be on the side of the road and, what the hell was that?
And they tested them, and a lot of the early models didn't even work.
Didn't even make a sound.
Yeah. But they're outside our hearing capability, so we couldn't hear it. We had to test it. So it's a perfect sales pitch, right? Deer can't hear. You can't hear, but the deer can.
Oh, yeah, man.
Okay, great. Well, then you'd have to work. you can't prove it.
Some people buy anything on hope, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are at time, gentlemen. So, again, I greatly appreciate you guys joining us for another episode on the podcast. Carl, one last thing. If listeners want to go find some of these studies that have been published by you guys, where do they go to find that kind of stuff?
Obviously most of this stuff has been published in the scientific literature, so you'd have to go on to Google Scholar or something like that and do a search under each one of these aspects, deer vision, or under my name or something like that, and those papers will show up. Now, they're going to be written as scientific studies that aren't going to be necessarily adapted for a hunter's applicability, but you have to infer that yourself. But I think doing stuff like, I've done a number of these types of podcasts as well, and this information is getting out there, the kind of stuff you guys are doing. I mean, this is a great resource for us to get the information that we're generating out to the general public so they can actually use what we're finding.
Yeah, one other good place where a lot of this has been written up in a more popular semi-scientific form would be on the National Deer Association website. So any of the printed material that they've got cataloged on these subjects could still be available, so that you could find it there and just Google Dr. Miller's name with some of this stuff, and there's been some articles written here and there over the years in various popular and semi-scientific magazines, and you can find it if you look hard enough.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, gentlemen, thank y'all again for joining us on the podcast. Listeners, thank y'all for listening. Viewers, thank you for watching. We'll catch you back on the next episode from Southern Outdoorsman Podcast. Remember, guys, y'all stay southern.
All right, y'all go ahead and mark your calendars. Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th is the Mobile Hunters Expo in Dalton, Georgia. Y'all have heard us talking about it for years, and it really is. It's the highlight of our summer. We absolutely love that show. We've met so many of you guys at that show over the years, and it is just it's like the perfect environment to go and meet like-minded hunters, hang out, have a good time, and get ready for deer season. So obviously, as the name implies, it is the place to go and try all of the mobile hunting gear coming out right now. We always recommend to people, if you're thinking about getting a new stand, a new sticks, a new saddle, go try it before you buy it. The Mobile Hunters Expo lets you try almost all the brands in the mobile hunting space in one spot in one day. There's really nothing like it. So not only do you have all that gear available to you, they also have a great speaker lineup. This year they've got Bobby Worthington, Dylan Harper, Mariah Boggess, Derek Norwood, and BHA all giving presentations where you can go learn from those guys and ask them questions. So if you've heard us talk about the Mobile Hunters Expo for a couple years now and haven't made it out yet, don't let this be another year that you miss it. Y'all come on out. We'll have a great time. We're excited to meet you guys there. We can't wait for it. We'll see y'all there. Again, mark y'all's calendars. It's at the Dalton Convention Center in Dalton, Georgia, Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th. See y'all there. All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic. And no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find basher groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just southern deer hunters or southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com.